The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
This morning, Mike Filiki Roshi, Mike Filiki Sensei, well, someday he'll be Mike Filiki Roshi, and I will be offering the Dharma talk together. I'm going to introduce it, and then Mike will pick it up and conclude the talk for this morning. I want to give you just a few guidelines about listening to a Dharma talk, reminders for most of you that you sit upright in your Zazen practice, and you receive the talk as if it was only being given for you. And it could be that some of it will touch your heart, and it could be that some of you will be confounded and confused. And it could be that you may just space out and not hear a word of it. And all of those are fine. I'm always very happy to give a talk at a sesshin because in our regular weekly practices, our talks are limited in time. Only about 10 minutes or so. We have to get right to the point, kind of like a Doksan Teisho. And here, we don't have to get right to the point. In a way, the point is everything we say, of course, but there's some freedom to explore something more deeply, more widely. So the teachers have chosen a koan to talk about for this sesshin. And for those of you who are not familiar with koans, but again, even for those of you who are, it's important to hear this koan not through your intellectual cognitive capacity, but through your heart, to hear the words when they come to you as poetry. In fact, this is poetry that was written around the 12th century in China. And there's some story elements and poetic elements, but mostly there are Dharma elements. So all of these words that I'm about to read to you and then comment on are words that are intended to direct you to the central point of Zen, which is the capacity that human beings have to awaken to our Buddha nature. This is direct, clear, and not too complicated by intellectual ideas or theories. So continuing to stay in your practice, continuing to stay in your body and your heart mind. A couple of characters who appear in this story that I'm about to read. One of them is Dao Wu, who has given us some wonderful koans, one about the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, where a student asks, what does she do with all her hands and eyes? And he says, it's like someone moving a pillow in the middle of the night. And there are other famous koans about Dao Wu. And the other character, another character in this story is Jian Yuan, who was his student, and Shi Shuang, who was also his student. So Dao Wu is the teacher, and Jian Yuan is one of the students, and Shi Shuang is the other student. And the case is number 55 in a collection called the Blue Cliff Record. And this is the pointer by the person who collected these koans, Yuan Wu. And this is what he says. Secure and intimate with the whole of reality, one obtains realization right here. In contact with the flow, able to turn things around, one assumes responsibility directly. As for cutting off confusion in the light of a stone-struck spark or a flash of lightning or towering up like a mile-high wall where one occupies the tiger's head and takes the tiger's tail? This I leave aside for the moment. Is there a way to help people by letting out a continuous path or not? To test, I cite this, look, in the case. Dawu and Jian Yuan went to a house to make a condolence call. Yuan hit the coffin and said, alive or dead? Wu, the teacher, said, I won't say alive and I won't say dead. Yuan said, why won't you say? Wu said, I won't say. Halfway back, as they were returning, Yuan said, tell me right away, teacher. If you don't tell me, I'll hit you. Wu said, you may hit me, but I won't say. Yuan then hit him. Later, Dao Wu passed on, and so Yuan went to Shishuang, his brother, his fellow student of Dao Wu, who was by then a teacher, and he brought up the foregoing story. Shuang said, I won't say alive and I won't say dead. Yuan said, why won't you say? Shuang said, I won't say, I won't say. At these words, Yuan had an insight. One day, Yuan took a hoe into the teaching hall and crossed back and forth from east to west and west to east. Shuang said, what are you doing? Yuan said, I'm looking for relics of our late master. Shuang said, vast waves spread far and wide, foaming billows flood the skies. What relics of our late master are you looking for? And Shui Do, who was one of the other collectors of this group of koans, adds a comment here saying, heavens, heavens. Yuan said, this is just where I should apply effort. And another teacher, Fu of Da Yuan, said, the late master's relics are still present. So there's so much going on in this koan. Don't try to grasp it or understand it, but maybe to just get the gist of what it means to face into death as these two people who lived so long ago, these ninth century Chinese humans who were just like us in so many ways, culturally different, historically different, but just like us, dealing with life and death, dealing with plagues and wars, political upheavals, and just the ordinary difficulties of being a human being on this planet, subject to greed and anger and delusion, with the capacity to awaken to the Buddha nature. And so this very sincere student, Jian Yuan, has gone with his teacher to pay a condolence call. These days, it's very common for Zen priests to do funerals, but apparently in those days it wasn't. So they had just gone to a neighbor's home where someone they knew, a neighbor of the temple, someone who had probably visited the temple, maybe donated food and money to the temple. Someone had died and they went to pay their respects. And of course, there's Zen people, Chan people, and maybe the people in the family who were grieving were used to odd behavior from them. And certainly what Yuan, the student, does, hitting the coffin, in some translations it says he touches it, but there's a lot of hitting going on later. So it seems like he probably did hit it, made a sound, and said this odd thing, alive or dead? Well, clearly dead, but what does he mean? And then why won't the teacher respond? And then later, as they're walking back to the temple, he just persists. Tell me. A really great student in many ways, someone who persists, who wants to know the answers to things, who won't just say, oh, well, whatever. This is someone that we look for in our Zen students, someone who cares so much about awakening and the Dharma, cares so much about this that they won't let go. And Dao Wu says this wonderful thing to him when he threatens to hit him. It's okay for you to hit me. If you hit me, I still won't tell you. And so the student hits the teacher, and then he still doesn't tell him. Now, I was curious about what were the consequences of hitting a teacher in the 8th century, 9th century in China. And it turns out they were pretty severe. You weren't supposed to do it. You weren't supposed to yell at your teacher or get into an argument or hit them, certainly. You weren't supposed to do that. But this guy did it. And Dao Wu, the teacher, knew that if anyone heard what had happened, they would be very upset with this student. And so he sent him away. There's a little elision in the story where later, when he goes to his Dharma brother, Shi Shuang, that happens apparently about 30 years after the funeral that was the subject of the beginning of the koan. And Yuan, Jian Yuan, who wandered away now without a teacher, without a sangha, without anything but his own sincere practice and questioning, after many years of wandering, finally found a place to settle down. And it was a temple that was dedicated to the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. And while he was there taking care of it, one of the local caretakers, who was someone from the village nearby, was coming in to clean and sweep and devote himself to the temple. And while he was doing this, he was chanting a sutra that is about Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And one of the lines in that sutra is that whatever we need, the Bodhisattva of compassion will take that form to teach us. So that if we're a priest, the Bodhisattva of compassion will take the form of a priest. And when he heard those words, when Jian Yuan heard those words, he had a great awakening. But by then his teacher was dead. And so he went to visit his old Dharma brother, Shi Shuang. And then the story continues where they have their interaction, where Shi Shuang says the same thing that now the dead teacher Dao Wu said, I won't say, I won't say. And now I will hand this over to Mike Sensei so that he too won't say.
That's such a beautiful story, and so powerful to imagine these two standing over the coffin. Here we are in the middle of a pandemic, so much loss of life, so much death. Also in the midst of, as we heard in our dedications, this ongoing racial injustice where we've all borne witness to painful examples of brutality. Can't help but recognize painful injustices in this world and loss of life connected with these things. And in this context, we take up this koan about life and death. Perhaps some of us even touched personally in our lives by loss. And this sincere investigation of the great matter on the part of our archetypal Zen student, standing over a coffin, standing over a body, and asking, inquiring, bringing up the teachings. We just read the Heart Sutra together. And in the Heart Sutra, we read, no old age and death, and also no ending of old age and death. Quite a koan there for us. Very much like the line, I won't say, no life and death, and also no ending of old age and death. So are there old age and death or not? I won't say, I won't say. How do we begin to investigate the great matter as students of the way? Of course, there is the mind which tells us, of course there's life and death. We've seen it, we witness it, we're touched by it. It seems uncompassionate to move into some sort of aloof Zen denial of life and death. Oh, I'm above it. There's no old age and death. I'm not touched by this world anymore. Somehow the opposite of Avalokiteshvara. And yet, this inquiry, what are life and death? We are invited to look more deeply. Of course, we recognize life and death, just as we recognize injustice. Our job is not to move into a place of uncompassionate denial above the world. What point? What benefit? We read in the opening lines of this koan, the commenter, the pointer. Is there a way to help people by letting out a continuous path or not? Is there a way to help people? Our bodhisattva vow to stay engaged and in the world. How do we help people? Standing over a corpse. In the commentary, it is described seven women sages were traveling through the forest of corpses. One of the women pointed to a corpse and asked her sisters, the corpse is here. Where is the person? The corpse is here. Where is the person? All of us who have lost loved ones have asked that question. The eldest sister said, "What? What?" And all seven together experienced the tolerance of birthlessness. No birth, no death. All life and death. Not one, not two. Both one and two. Alive or dead, I won't say, I won't say. Thank you, everyone.
So please make yourselves comfortable. And Mike and I and David will all do our best to respond to you when you raise your Zoom hand to make a comment or a question. Yes, we'll start with Will.
Thank you very much for the Dharma talk, both of you. I guess I'll start with a thought, which is that the way that death and life seem to occupy the same territory for me was brought back to me by this story. And that is that when you die, for you, everything is gone, everything, right? Everything, everything. And that is the same everything that when in just sitting in Shikantaza, as Melissa hopefully says, nothing is excluded. And it really is sort of unthinkable with the cognitive mind, right? That this everything, but death, and death sort of reminds you that it's a thing, right? There is an everything. It is everything. Everything's gone, including self and other. So to me, that's very, that's sort of a, this paradoxical identity of life and death seems to land there. And I guess, maybe my question might seem more trivial, but my favorite part of the whole thing, maybe it's related. My favorite part of the whole thing is the, if I understood this right, in the opening comment, there's something about building tall towers and occupying the head of the tiger and the tail of the tiger. You get this very intense image, or at least I did, of that being that tiger. And then he says, "I won't talk about that." and so suddenly there it's emptied out. This tiger that you were working on or beginning to inhabit, I'm not talking about that. It's gone. It's gone. So there's this kind of emptying out of the thing. Maybe there's, more to that story that I don't understand, but that was how it struck me. So I guess it's not really a question, just a couple of observations. But thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's quite ironic that he says he won't talk about it, and yet the whole case is about it.
And appreciating, Will, this unthinkable quality that we're invited in, this empty, full, there is this I won't say, creates this vast space, this vast inconceivable unthinkable space that we are invited into. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Lori Sensei.
Thank you. I love this koan, and I haven't thought about it in a long time. So this was really wonderful. And for me, when I think of trying to become intimate with life and death in a way that I can really feel, I often just think about one round of zazen, 30 minutes of zazen, and all the tiny little births and the tiny little deaths that happen right there. So every inhale as a birth, every exhale as a death, every coming of a thought or an emotion or a sensation as something being born and something dying. And when I really look at this in zazen, and I was doing this during this talk, it's very often hard to tell which is going with what's dying and what's being born. It's hard to make that, draw that line. So thank you for reminding me of this.
A wonderful commentary. I love the, you know, what both you and Will are pointing to in this, and especially you, Lori, the birth and death happening continuously every moment, over and over and over again. And you can really see it when you're practicing zazen. It's very clear if you're paying any kind of attention at all that there's this and then that's gone and then there's this and then that's gone. And there's a refreshing quality to that, to settle into, I don't need to hold on to anything and I don't need anything to be a certain way. It's just, here's the passing show. And there's so much learning just from that. You know, like Hakuin Zenji says in the Song of Zazen, zazen is the root of all the teachings. That's why we do sesshin, so we can do a lot of zazen. Thank you.
I just want to add that before the talk, I was walking, and I knew that this was the koan we were talking about, so found myself practicing with it very much the way you're describing, Lori, and feeling each step on the ground as birth and death. And such a beautiful mystery here. Of course, we're talking about form and emptiness. We're talking about existence and non-existence, being and non-being. And not to get too philosophical here, but the way that they are so, these are words that we're using to point toward our experience, toward something that cannot be pinned down. And the mind wants to separate it into categories. And yet the living mystery, quite beyond all categories. Living mystery.
Yeah. Barry, I think.
I like that knock-knock joke, but it's not very funny. And a passage that has given me great comfort comes from Shunryu Suki talking about an experience he had at Yosemite. And he talks about the river pouring off the cliff and something weird happens. The torrent separates into individual droplets, which he likens to individual human beings. And he says some good things happen to some of the droplets and not so good to others. So the metaphor is that's their lifespan and they come crashing back into the river and rejoin the river of being. And to me, that's what that koan is about. There's no answer about life or death.
Yeah, and what's, it's a wonderful story. What's your experience in your life that might demonstrate the same thing? So not somebody else's experience, but your experience.
Well, I'm old, so I've had a lot of people die in my life. And they go into the river of being, but they still live on in my own version of it.
Yes.
So
yes.
There's a continuity, but an ending.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. That's much more to the point than the beautiful story you told.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Dawn.
Thank you very much, both of you, for the talk. Among the many things to appreciate about both of your koans, I like the context that you add, Melissa, with the history and everything outside of the story itself. And one thing that I really enjoyed was that it was a 30-year lesson. It just happened like right then. He kept processing it. So in a way, it just, yeah, I really appreciate that.
You know, I didn't know that until I was preparing for the talk. And as you said it, Dawn, here was a guy who was really impatient. You know, I want to know it now. Tell me now. I'll even hit you. And the teacher just must know on some level that he needs those 30 years to mature and nurture. There's a commentary by Hakuin, as a 17th century Japanese teacher, who talks about that in a life of practice, there's all kinds of moments of waking up. There's not just this one big, and then you're all done, and now I'm going to go, you know, cross country skiing or whatever. It's like constant questioning. And I think this guy, Jian Yuan, is a great exemplar of that. It doesn't mean that you have to be a patient person. He was not a patient person, but life will do that to us. You know, this, it really never ends.
And I appreciate how we're both expanding the time horizon and narrowing it. So there is this flow of our life does us, or our life undoes us. There is no pushing it in some ways. It's happening. And then this invitation not to imagine that life and death and old age will happen at some other moment. We're not talking about some abstract thing here, but the experience of being human, of breathing in and breathing out, of this this life that is only coming and going, only living and dying, a moment, micro moment after micro moment, not philosophy.
Yeah. You know, I loved what Barry said too about if you've lived a life of any length, you've had a lot of death in your life. It's just the way it is. And somehow this year has been an acceleration of that. No matter how old we are, it's not just COVID, but we've often heard or read or even seen things on television over the decades where people are being killed. But it's somewhat abstract. This year, it stopped being abstract because of social media and people being filmed, being murdered by police. And it's just like any human being who's paying attention this year cannot avoid this question any longer. It's right here and so important. So there's been kind of an acceleration, I think, of facing into life and death this year. John.
Well, when I heard the koan, I first started thinking intellectually, and the first thing that came to my head was Schrodinger's cat. You know that old one?
Oh, yeah.
And that's totally Western. And then I thought, like you said, something about personal experience and feelings and so forth. And yesterday, after we had our meetings, I felt really into the moment. And I was thinking, as I was shaving last night, how much my face has changed over the years. You know, I mean, I remember how it used to be so easy to shave this way. And now I have to, you know, sort of do certain things so I can get it there. And it reminds me that, you know, I'm getting older and I've been thinking about that. And, you know, I've already told my niece that I want a simple funeral based on a old, I think it's a country Western song, something about, I want a simple funeral. I don't need to spend the money on a big tombstone or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then a relative of mine by marriage was murdered a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And he had a fancy funeral and people are, you know, mourning. And, you know, it does bring it to you, even if you're not close to the person. You know, knowing someone that you know, everybody dies, but, you know, being murdered is a little bit different than being dying of old age, which most likely people say, I'm going to die of old age, but who knows?
Right. You know, the unexpected possibility of death, of course, always expected on some level, but so abstract, so distant when we think about it usually, and we often keep it at arm's length. But, you know, as you're describing here, death doesn't stay at arm's length despite our wishes. And unfortunately, sometimes touches those we love and inevitably comes for us. I'm so sorry to hear about your relative by marriage. That's awful. I think for all of us with this powerful presence of death in our lives now, this does call to us, this mystery, right? This mysterious, you know, we started with a little bit from Will, everything disappears for us. And how do I know? Is everything still here or is it not here? What do I know? This place of curiosity and investigation and not knowing and diving into our practice in this moment as we're shaving our faces. How is this also life and death? Yeah. Thank you, John.
Corwin.
Wasn't expected quick.
So
when John just mentioned Schrodinger's cat, of course my brain started going off on that as well. And I was just thinking, somebody else had said that someone passed away, but they live on in our memories. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, both alive and dead at the same time. And then I thought about how, you know, we talk about in Zen, the great death, the death of self, where we drop our ego away and the self disappears. But that's that moment of enlightenment. And if we're already enlightened, then we're also already dead while we're alive at the same time. And so it's just watching my brain go through all these different depths of the same thing going, okay, so we're all the cat that's both dead and alive at the same time. And my head is spinning again. But it's great to see this reflected in so many places. So yeah. Thank you.
Well, and to notice how the mind just wants either or, you know, the mind so believes in these concepts that we've created. And just appreciating we don't have to try to stop the mind. We can go, oh, yeah. Wow, look at that. And of course, in the end, there's no escape. This is it too.
Corwin, you reminded me also of a wonderful book title. I think it's Stephen Levine, who writes this book title, Who Dies? And it's a very interesting book. But, you know, the koanic aspect of the koan, that invitation that you're taking on, the answer to this koan is often another question. Who dies? What? What?
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Aaron.
While you were reading the koan, I found myself just wondering how angry the student was, like when it was really happening. Sounds kind of calm, but I was trying to imagine him actually hitting his teacher and hitting the coffin and how much desperation or how much.
Yeah, I think this is such an important part of the koan. This was not a philosophical question this student was asking. but really some incredible, I have to know, I have to know.
Yeah, and there's one way when we're working with this koan in our tradition to really enter all of the characters. And so entering the mind, heart, and body of this guy who was right there in front of a dead body. You know, who knows, maybe it was the first time he'd ever seen one, but he was definitely stirred up. And feel that fully. That's really wonderful. Yeah, thanks, Aaron. Pierce?
Thank you for the talk and for picking a koan that will keep me puzzling. But two things. One is that, you know, my father's been dead a long time, but I still ask that question every now and then, where the hell is he? And I wouldn't admit this to many people, but since you're all crazy Zen folks like me, I think it's okay. But that's my feeling about the way the question functions. You know, it's not something that I'm expecting to get an answer to, but it is tremendously urgent at the same time, and it provides a direction. And I'm not surprised that the guy 30 years later is still asking the question.
Yeah.
The second thing is I'm reading Dogen's poetry, and I happen to read his death poem. And the last line is, in one translation, living I plunge into yellow springs. Yellow springs meaning death. And there's something really uncanny about that for me, because he's saying living, not that I die and then I'm dead, but living, I enter into it. And I think that really, you know, birth and death together there, not separate.
Yeah. I love that so much. That's again, another important aspect of the Zen orientation towards life and death. That, and it also, when I was a grief counselor back in the day and worked at hospice and with homicide survivors and all this kind of stuff, we kept seeing the same phenomena over and over and over again, that people who were dying, not people who'd been murdered because that was a sudden death, but a slower death, were alive all the way until the moment that they weren't. And that little moment where the breath, the out breath, isn't followed by an in breath, so powerful. Those of us who had witnessed it ever were changed by it. And we also used to, this whole thing about alive or dead, we had many, I can tell you this joke because, as you said, Pierce, we're all crazy. And we were all crazy, the people who were doing grief counseling. It was very, you know, dramatic and difficult, but we observed another phenomena which we called phone calls from the dead. And it was that even now, my mother's been dead for 35 years, the phone rings and sometimes I think, oh, maybe it's mom. Oh, you know, that there so there is, as I think Corwin was pointing to and a number of you, this weird thing about time. You know, that time gets compressed and they really are alive. And what is, and this is why alive or dead, 30 years later, 60 years later, to our dying breath. And the answer really is, I don't know. I don't know. I can't say, I won't say. Yeah. So thank you. Jenny.
So thinking about the way we still have the people that have died and thinking about the way we don't really have the people that haven't. I mean, like, I have a friend that's facing death, you know, a lot more than usual, and I haven't seen him in like a year, and I've talked on the phone a few times and had a few emails, but mostly I'm just carrying around my puppet of him, and the same way the same way of the people that live in the house with me. And in that, I mean, I have those puppets of the people that have died. So, but then also when the people died, there was like this closing of doors, this loss of potential. And I guess that mm-hmm. what represents like all these things I was caring about what will be someday or what might be someday. And then like the letting go, no, that will never be. So I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but I felt all sick about trying to talk, so it must be important.
Jenny, I think that's a beautiful, very poetic expression of this, you know, sometimes we call it a dance, right? Between having and not having, between life and death, permanence and impermanence, the way our minds construct reality, entering into the mystery of how it really is, quite ungraspable. And that ungraspable quality that you are illuminating so beautifully. And how that is such a central part of this koan. Right at the heart of the koan is this ungraspability.
And just from my own experience about losing people in my life, the relationship continues and transforms. Death isn't the end, at least that it hasn't been that way for me. It took me a while to understand that, but my relationship with my mother, my father, other people who I've lost over the years, it's still going on. And it's not the same as it was when they were alive. And I'm happy for that. You know, going back to the Schrodinger's cat analogy, or the phone calls from the dead, the relationship continues somehow. It's very mysterious.
And there is a closing of the door, as you say, something does end to say, everything goes on is not correct. Mm-hmm. To say it doesn't go on is not correct.
They're both not correct.
Which is why I won't say.
That's right. And we're going to have to end this Dharma dialogue now so that we can get back to sitting and investigating the matter in silence. But we're grateful to everyone who contributed, everyone who wanted to contribute, and everyone who listened. So that means all of us. So thank you. And we'll come back just for a few moments to sit in Zazen, and then we'll be taken somewhere else.